Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Lynn Wilson. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Wilson is a professor of therapeutic radiology and an expert in the use of radiation to treat lung cancers and cutaneous lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, Dr. Wilson is joined by Dr. Michael Kinch. Dr. Kinch is Managing Director for the Yale Center for Molecular Discovery. Here's Lynn Wilson.
Let's start off by having you tell us a little bit about what you do.
Okay. So I'm in charge of what's known as the Yale Center for Molecular Discovery, which is a recent combination of two different centers at Yale. One was known as the Yale Small Molecule Discovery Center, and the other was known as the Yale High Throughput Cell Biology Center. And basically, to give you a little bit of an idea of what the center does, I can give you a little bit of idea what my background is.
Sure.
So I started life off as a professor. I was actually a cancer researcher. My focus was in breast and prostate cancer. And we had identified novel ways of targeting metastatic cells with a type of therapeutic known as a monoclonal antibody. About 4 or 5 years into my professordom, after I had gotten tenure, I was approached by a biotechnology company that was interested not only in the technology we had developed, but also in asking if I could leave academia and start a oncology program at this biotech company. This company is known as MedImmune, which was a small biotech at the time, and it grew quite large. And so we were able to go through a really fun time where the growth of the company was pretty dramatic. We increased the number of cancer programs we had from basically a handful to more than about 24. About 5 years after MedImmune, I was recruited by a gentleman by the name of Stan Cohen to be the chief scientific officer at a biotech company about a mile down the road. And this was a small startup company. And the reason for raising that is that in the time that I was in academia, large pharma or biotech, and then small biotech, the field has transitioned quite a bit, which led to why I came to Yale and why I'm at the center. And that is that large pharmaceutical companies have largely pulled out of the early research and development of new therapeutics. They tend to want to become involved in the development of therapeutics more at the clinical stage level, after there's already some evidence from the clinic of that a drug is going to be useful. The difficulty is that in the past, that gap that has been formed by the drug company pulling back has been filled in by biotechnology companies. The issue is that the venture capital for biotechnology companies has more or less evaporated. And while there is still some out there, to a large degree, investors, especially since the economic downturn, are less inclined to invest in smaller companies. That creates a real situation for new drug development, because in the past, perhaps a professor might have an idea, be able to get a venture capitalist or what's known as an angel investor to invest in it and then advance the drug down the road. That option is not so much of an option anymore. So what we're trying to do at the center is to identify opportunities to advance something beyond perhaps just an initial idea that an investigator has into something that's a bit more tangible. And so that leads to the idea that we have in the center of being able to expand these inventions as much as we can, take them further down the road than they might have otherwise, with the goal not of competing with the Pfizers and the Mercks of the world, but rather to identify projects that are perhaps the best opportunities at the university, advance them to the point where the Pfizers and the Mercks or the venture capitalists might be more inclined to want to license those programs.
And obviously, this work is expensive and resource intensive. And with the evaporation of venture capital, who's paying for this?
So that is a big issue, and that's the issue in drug development. What we're trying to do is to find unique and creative ways for underwriting a lot of this work. That's also what I had to do in my last job in a biotechnology company, because again, the money is just not there like it was. So what we've been trying to do is to take an approach where, first of all, the university underwrites a substantial portion of what we do. And the rationale for that is that we are tasked with generating value for the university by advancing these inventions down the road, by, if nothing else, providing tools for the investigator they wouldn't otherwise have, and therefore being able to generate new grants, new manuscripts, and other sorts of items of value to the university. In addition, what we've done very recently, we made an announcement just 2-3 months ago, is to identify opportunities for industry to become involved in our work. And specifically, what we've done is to practice a model in which we've worked with a major pharmaceutical company who has underwritten some of the work that we do. They receive basically nothing other than the ability to see, to get an idea of what we do. So in the past, what has occurred often is that a large company will negotiate a license with a university, for example, for a fair amount of money. That project will be taken aboard by that company in advance. The problem that the pharmaceutical companies have had is that they invest lots of money, lots of time and resources, and the project may not work at the end of the day. Perhaps something, especially early on in the life of the program, might have been not perfect. And that turned into that slight imperfection became more and more of a problem, and the project didn't advance. Plus, science isn't a guaranteed to work, so oftentimes things don't work. What we've basically reached out to the pharmaceutical companies to do is to say to them, if you became involved at an earlier stage, and if nothing else, you monitor what's going on, that can give you a better feel as the projects evolve into whether you would want to make the investment to move into this. So our goal is to try to interact with as many different, have a company interact with as many different projects as possible, help us advance those programs, at the same time help the pharmaceutical company or biotech partner be able to identify which programs they would like to advance forward.
So this is really fascinating information and fascinating endeavor. How did you first get interested in this? I mean, as a young kid, were you interested in science? Did something happen in college? Where was the spark?
So I've always, like many scientists, enjoyed science from the beginning. I had a great love for it, everything except, ironically, for biology. Growing up, math and physics were fantastic, and I held off until, I believe it was late in my sophomore year, before I took my first biology class in college, and then became immediately hooked. My interest in biology probably, though, coincided greatly with the fact that actually within my family itself, we had a high incidence of cancer. I lost two grandfathers as a result of colon cancer, and many other relatives as well. And as a matter of fact, about 5 years ago, I found myself in the opposite seat from what I normally did at the National Cancer Institute. So as we discussed before the program started, until very recently, we lived in the Gaithersburg, Maryland area. And what had happened was that it turns out that the high incidence of cancer within my family was the result of a genetic predisposition that it turns out that our family had to a particular type of colon cancer. And so I had given many talks at the National Cancer Institute down in Bethesda, and it turns out that one day I found myself in the opposite seat, where I was actually the subject of a genetic study of cancer. And it turns out that it looks like in my particular case, I didn't end up having the marker that led to this, but it gives you a whole new appreciation for the entire, what cancer is and how it can impact your life. And again, you go from it being a theory to all of a sudden it's a real life thing,
right?
Not just for your family, but for yourself.
Really changes your perspective on things.
Absolutely.
So tell us a little bit more, tell the listeners a bit more about the center. How long has it been in existence? Tell us a little bit about its expansion and growth since it started.
So the center's been around for about 5 or 6 years. It was originally started by a faculty member in the Molecular, Cellular, and Developmental Biology Department by the name of Craig Cruz. At the time, there were actually two centers. Craig founded one of these centers, which was known as the Yale Small Molecule Discovery Center. And its job, its original mandate upon creation, was to be able to advance the discoveries that the investigators make by creating new tools, and specifically a set of molecules known as small molecules. Small molecules are basically, just like the name sounds, molecules that are quite small, that most conventional therapeutics are small molecules. And the issue is that anytime you have a chemical, you need to be able to identify that you have chemicals that work the way in which you want them to work and don't have what's known as off-target or side effects. And so the job of the center originally was to screen for these molecules and identify those that potentially could be research tools and potentially could also lead to something that might down the road be a therapeutic when put into the right hands. The center itself has actually been very successful. They've had, I think to date, more than about 80 programs have been successfully completed. The actually three, I believe, local biotechnology companies spun out of activities that went on at the center. And a number of different licensing opportunities have occurred. In addition, and more fundamentally, the center has a good track record as far as being able to deliver to the investigator those tools that the investigators need for grants and for publications and for other opportunities in academic medicine as well.
What sort of growth has there been over that 5 years? Did it start as a relatively small group and got much bigger? Where do we stand in terms of that?
It has remained at roughly the same size until the recent merger. So it started off as two or three individuals, and we're now up to about 12. But approximately half of those were from another center, which we can talk about a little bit later. But one of the goals that we have as a center is to try to stay small and elite. We want to be able to be as nimble as possible with regards to being able to have an elite group of people that can do work as well as they can and as well as is possible. One joke that we have within the center is that we strive to be number two in everything that we do. And the reason for that is that if we're number one and we're leading the development, for example, of a new technology, that takes a lot of energy and effort that we'd have to put into that technology that we couldn't put into the projects that we get from our faculty investigators. On the other hand, if we're number three, or if we're number four or five, and there are technologies that are very well done that can be done elsewhere, faster, better, or cheaper, we'd rather hire those people to do it for us. Instead, we like to be number two and be able to do something that is just beyond cutting edge and that's providing something, that's providing a service to the faculty that cannot be obtained otherwise, and to be able to move forward with that.
I see. That's an interesting philosophy and approach. Tell us a little bit more about who exactly is involved and what are their roles in the center.
Okay, so I lead the center, but the day-to-day operations are actually run by, on the biology side, by a scientist by the name of Janie Merkel, who has been with the center for about 6 years. To put that into perspective, I've been with the center for about a year and a half. So Janie's really seen it through its full evolution. In addition to Janie, on the chemistry side, we were fortunate to be able to recruit a chemist from Pfizer. And he's now leading some of the more untraditional approaches towards chemistry that pharmaceutical companies have routinely practiced, but within academia have not been utilized. And so that's going to help us to be able to advance some of the discoveries that we make as far as small molecules that we discover, make them better, make them higher quality, take some of the risk out of the side effects and otherwise that might otherwise have come out of it. And that investigator, Denton Hoyer, again, we brought him on board from Pfizer and have been able to take advantage of having a real hybrid between academia and industry. And about half of the people within the center have a biotech background, and about half have academia. And that also is consistent with the fact that the way in which we operate is very different than other sorts of centers within universities. Oftentimes what you have are a center where an investigator will come with an idea, and you'll have within the center a lot of equipment, and the center head will say to the investigator, you know, have at it, make use of the equipment as you would like. In other cases, a center will basically take over the project from the investigator and move it forward. We've taken a bit of a different approach where we will link an individual from the laboratory that made the initial discovery with someone from the center. We'll help adapt the work that's done within the laboratory to the center and then move forward with that. And that gets at a major problem because the types of experiments that are done in a laboratory day to day by a normal investigator are very different than what, for example, pharmaceutical industry does. And it may be that in a pharmaceutical industry, you have an experiment that is done once or twice a year for 10 years, whereas in an investigator's lab, all the work may be done in a month or two. So it takes a certain robustness and a consistency in the experiments that occurs over time. What we've done is to try to create a center staff that allows us to do that. And so we can talk more about that if you're interested after the break.
We're going to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about the Yale Center for Molecular Discovery with Dr. Kinch.
It's estimated that nearly 200,000 men in the U.S. will be diagnosed with prostate cancer this year, and 1 in 6 American men will develop prostate cancer in the course of his lifetime. Fortunately, major advances in the detection and treatment of prostate cancer have dramatically decreased the number of men who die from the disease. Screening for prostate cancer can be performed quickly and easily in a physician's office using 2 simple tests, a physical exam and a blood test. With screening, early detection, and a healthy lifestyle, prostate cancer can be defeated. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers like the one at Yale to test innovative new treatments for prostate cancer. The Da Vinci robotic surgical system is an option available for patients at Yale that uses 3-dimensional imaging to enable the surgeon to perform a prostatectomy without the need for a large incision. This has been a Medical Minute, and more information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Lynn Wilson, and I'm joined by my guest, Dr. Michael Kinch, and we're discussing the Yale Center for Molecular Discovery. Dr. Kinch, tell us a little bit more about some of the items we were discussing during the break.
Okay, so one of the things we were talking about is how we are trying to translate work that goes on in the investigator's basic research laboratory into something where there is a translational potential, an opportunity for a drug to end up in a pharmaceutical company's hands. There's an interesting set of articles that have come out. One was an editorial in the Wall Street Journal, and another was an article in the journal Nature, which is the preeminent science journal, one of the 2 or 3 top preeminent science journals in the world. And in both of them, the former head of oncology at Amgen, my counterpart at Amgen when I was at MedImmune, I knew the gentleman quite well, has pointed out that the failure rate for academic corporate partnerships is exceedingly high. And he's gone around and given a series of speeches, including one in New Haven last April 1st, in which he's pointed out that greater than 90% of all corporate academic partnerships fail utterly, with no value being generated for either partner, the academic or for the company. And furthermore, in this Nature review or Nature article, he pointed out that the greater than 90% of the work that's published by academic investigators cannot be reproduced in a corporate laboratory. And that creates, obviously, lots and lots of problems, because if you can't reproduce someone's work and you can't move it forward, where are the new ideas going to come from? And there's a potential for there to be a lot of finger pointing, where the corporate world can look at the academic world and say, well, obviously, you know, you're wrong, or you're only showing the most preferential data. And the academic investigator can look at the corporate investigator and say, well, you're just incompetent, and that's why you can't reproduce the findings. And I think that our approach at the centers is that we believe that it's actually something in between. And that is that fundamentally, the type of research that goes on in a corporate laboratory and the type of research that goes on in an academic laboratory are very, very different from one another. And when people talk about translational medicine, they're generally talking about translation from the bench in the laboratory to the clinic. But there's actually another translation from the investigator to the company that needs to occur. And as we were mentioning before, there's an appreciation of the fact that an experiment may be done in a company for many months, and in some cases, many years, whereas an investigator may do this experiment once or twice, or let's say even 5 or 10 times over a month or two period. And so a year later, a different student or a different postdoctoral fellow or whoever it is that's doing the experiment may have a very different approach and not be able to even reproduce the findings of their predecessor. Much less than if you now go into a corporate environment where you have a very different set of machinery. You have a very separate and different type of an approach. To give you an example, an investigator in an academic laboratory will oftentimes do an experiment in centrifuge tubes or in microfuge tubes, where one experiment at a time, perhaps 10 or 15 different samples in an experiment. That same experiment in a corporate setting may be done 150, 200,000 times per day for days and days on end. And so that requires a different type of technology, a different type of translation. And that's what one of our goals is, to try to achieve that hybrid of the academic and industry approach. to help from an educational standpoint to make the academic investigator aware of what the constraints and the realities are within the corporate world, and the other way around in the pharmaceutical industry, to make them appreciate that when we say that we've given the good seal approval, if you will, to this particular type of an experiment, they'll have a greater satisfaction that and belief that this is going to be able to be reproduced in their laboratories and allow them to initiate the development towards a new medicine or a new drug.
Well, it certainly sounds like there are a lot of challenges. If it was easy, then it wouldn't be as interesting and everybody would be doing it. So this is interesting stuff. Getting back to the small molecules, you had briefly described what a small molecule is. What's their role in cancer?
So most conventional treatments for cancer are actually known as small molecules. They are molecules that are, again, very small. They are generally targeted for a particular activity, specifically in cancer, generally to try to kill the cancer cell without killing the normal cell. Now, a small molecule can be distinguished from a large molecule. And there are many different types of large molecules, but perhaps the most well-known are monoclonal antibodies or antibodies. So either antibodies that are given to you that are made in the laboratory, or the type of antibody that once you receive an immunization that you produce yourself. So the big discriminator between small molecules and large molecules or antibodies is simply their size. An antibody may be what's known as 150,000 Daltons, a Dalton being a type of measurement unit, whereas a small molecule may be 200 or 300. So it's considerably smaller in size. Now, again, most conventional cancer drugs are small molecules, but with the advent of Erbitux and Avastin and other therapeutics for cancer that are monoclonal antibodies, large molecules and more targeted therapies have received at least a lot more of the press in the last few years. But still the majority of therapeutics that are out there are small molecules.
I see. And what's been the growth curve for small molecules over the last 5 to 10 years? Has it been fairly linear? Is it becoming explosive in terms of discovery?
Both in small molecule and large, and just for the record, our particular center doesn't distinguish among them. The growth in as far as the new drugs that have been approved and the growth with regards to new drugs that have sold very well by pharmaceutical and biotechnology companies has really been skewed towards large molecules over the last maybe 5 to 10 years. Matter of fact, my background is in large molecules, and there have been quite a few mergers in the last 5 to 10 years, and they continue today, where many small molecules, traditionally small molecule companies, are acquiring large molecule capabilities, oftentimes through mergers and acquisitions. For example, my old company was purchased, MedImmune was purchased by AstraZeneca. That's representative of many others, where Genentech, for example, was purchased by Roche. And there are many other examples of that. So one of the frustrations that I think all of us feel, and one of the disappointments over the last few years, has been that the approval of all drugs, small and large, has not kept pace with what the hope is for the future. And I think that with some regulatory changes and a recognition of a lot of new science that's occurred in the last few years, that will improve. But at the moment, of course, we're not approving things as quickly as we want to. And again, that's part of the reason that the center is here, is because there's been the creation of what's known as the Valley of Death, which is basically the valley being created, if you will, between what the basic research that's generally done in the universities and the research that's generally done in the pharmaceutical companies that's further along in the development of the drug. In between, there's a chasm of work that isn't yet been, that no one really knows how that's going to be funded and how that work is going to be supported over time. Compounding that is the fact that in addition to a changing regulatory environment where the FDA, its conditions for approving drugs and monitoring safety seem to be varying quite a bit over the last decade or so, is the fact that the pharmaceutical industry really is probably not going to be recognizable in 10 or 15 years compared to what it is today and what it has been in the past. And I think many companies, and pretty much all companies, appreciate the fact that the industry is going to look very different in about a decade, but no one knows what it's going to look like. And no one knows what the hybrids are going to look like, such as the center that we have and others, how that's going to contribute to what the model looks like. So it's a exciting time of experimentation, not just in the science itself, but also in the business of how new medicines are going to be discovered and moved forward.
For our listeners, if you've identified a small molecule that looks very promising, tell us a little bit about the regulatory timeline between that discovery and when a human being can actually be treated with that medication or small molecule and benefit from that?
It's a great question, and it's the big issue that companies face. And it's also, keep this in mind, if you're a financial investor investing in a new biotech company, this is something that people keep in mind as well. Oftentimes, from when a new discovery is made, let's say that someone has identified a new molecule that might be targeted in cancer. You hear about these breakthroughs all the time in the press. It can be 5 or 10 years until the drug has gone through all of what's known as preclinical research and has reached a point where a document known as an investigational new drug application, or an IND, is submitted. The importance of the IND is that this is what now allows, it's the gateway that allows the clinical trials of that drug to begin. And so a good 5 or 10 years, and I believe the average is somewhere between $200 and $500 million worth of investment can go into a therapeutic until it reaches that point. The vast majority of therapeutics or attempted therapeutics that reach that point fail. So I think the estimate is at least 9 out of 10 fail for every one that gets into the clinic. Then you enter sort of the human clinical side of things, and that can again last anywhere from perhaps, I think the earliest that I've ever heard of is 3 to 4 years of clinical investigation, up to 10 or 15, 20 years, depending upon the type of trial that it is. And so when you're looking at it now altogether, you can be looking at 20 to 30 years from a basic discovery until the point where that drug is actually approved by the Food and Drug Administration and can be given to patients. Now, some patients may be able to get it while it's in clinical trials, but again, at that point, it's still an experiment and it's still an investigation, and so there's no guarantee of activity. But the part of what our center is attempting to do is to shorten that timeline, particularly that preclinical timeline. And there's a great deal of interest in, I know, the Yale Cancer Center and in others and in the FDA in determining how can we shorten the process while preserving the safety potential. I think Vioxx and other approved drugs that subsequently ran into safety issues has made people cautious, rightly so, but there's clearly a balance that needs to be achieved, and we're in the process of just trying to determine how to achieve that best.
What are some of the departments within the Cancer Center that you and your team have interacted with?
We've actually interacted with almost all of the different departments within the Cancer Center and many different departments within the university. We are fortunate in that we have interactions with the most basic of basic science. Part of what we do is actually the discovery of some of these new targets that might be targeted, be it by small molecules or antibodies. But we also are doing other investigations, for example, on looking at drug combinations. It's pretty well established that 1 plus 1 can equal 10, in that if you have one drug that works well and another drug that works well, the combination of that can work really well. And so we have been working with some investigators at the Cancer Center to be able to advance some of those and identify what are the good combinations. Likewise, 1 plus 1 can be, they can cancel each other out or even, Lord forbid, be toxic. And so we've been working with some of the later stage drugs for that. So we've been fortunate to be able to work with many different aspects of the Cancer Center.
How important is basic science in the development of these new treatments?
The basic science is key. Obviously, understanding of the targets, knowing what the target is that you might be able to go after, and how it's going to work is important. What's been interesting is that as a safety concern, the FDA is placing greater emphasis on understanding exactly how your drug is working, rather than just the more what in the past might have been anecdotal information that a particular molecule works. I used to teach chemotherapy to medical students in a past life. And one of the things that we used to emphasize is that some of the best working cancer drugs were discovered by accident. One component of mustard gas, for example, it was noticed that in the trenches of World War I, some of the veterans who had been exposed to mustard gas, some of their cancers got better. Some got worse. And that led to some investigation. And no one really knew what was happening, why it was working, in some cases until decades later. That's in the past. Now it's generally understood that you need to understand exactly how your molecule is functioning, how it is that you're going to be intervening against the cancer cell, and importantly, not hurting the normal cell. And that's essential because, again, we want to minimize the likelihood that a Vioxx-like event, where you have an unforeseen toxicity that occurs, there's a real emphasis in trying to minimize that that's going to happen.
Can you give us some examples of some of the new research that you're really excited about?
I think there are many different opportunities. It'd be hard to narrow it down to one. We have quite a few different programs where very fundamental differences between cancer cells and benign cells have been identified and allowed us to be able to target it. So I think that it'd be hard to limit it to one, but I believe there is great potential in the future.
Dr. Michael Kinch is Managing Director for the Yale Center for Molecular Discovery. If you have questions or would like to add your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.